Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations from coast to coast. This edition was produced on Fort William First Nations territory at CILU in Thunder Bay, Ontario.
It just seems like the past 20 years we've seen a list of false promises or broken promises from NAFTA.
We have a government that is pushing resource extraction, and so the violence on the land is increasing. It makes sense that violence against women would go hand in hand with that.
The National Energy Board in its history has never actually rejected a pipeline before.
In this edition, we hear about an initiative to create a community-run database of missing and murdered Indigenous women, a reflection on the impact of the NAFTA agreement after 20 years, and a community radio report about the project Groundwire. But first, here are the headlines. Two Montreal-based activists were arrested in Mexico last week, where they remain in prison under serious charges. CKUT's Aaron Lakoff has the story.
Amélie Pelletier and Fallon Rouillet-Poisson, two Montreal activists, were arrested in Mexico City on January 5th, along with a Mexican man known as Carlos. Pelletier and Poisson are two well-known and respected anarchist activists in Montreal who recently were actively involved in the Quebec student strike. The Mexican government is accusing them of throwing Molotov cocktails at a building belonging to the country's Ministry of Communications and Transportation, as well as a Nissan car dealership in Mexico City. On January 9th, a Mexican federal judge granted a special detention order which will keep the three behind bars for an additional 40 days until formal charges are laid. The prolonged pretrial detention will allow for CISEN, the Mexican Special Intelligence Services, to investigate the alleged crimes. Since being detained, the three have had limited contact with anyone, including their lawyer, and Amélie and Fallon have also been visited by the Canadian consulate. Though they were initially accused of property destruction, the three may now face additional charges of sabotage, organized crime, and terrorism. If these charges are brought forward, bail will not be possible, and deportation for the two back to Canada is highly unlikely. Community organizer and supporter of the three, Jaggi Singh, spoke at a support rally outside the Mexican consulate on January 9th.
The Mexican justice system, like all systems created to protect private property in the interests of the rich, is repressive and authoritarian and considers those detained to be guilty until proven innocent.
Another support rally was held in Montreal on January 11th, and an international day of support has been called for January 17th. The Anti-Capitalist Convergence of Montreal, CLAC, is calling for donations on their website and posting regular updates at www.clac-montreal.net. For Groundwire, this is Aaron Lakoff reporting from CKUT Radio in Montreal.
In December, the National Energy Board approved the Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipeline. Josh Brandon of Mud and Water Radio, CKUW, has this story.
The proposed 1,200-kilometer, $8 billion pipeline would carry bitumen oil from the tar sands of Alberta to the northern coast of British Columbia. The ruling comes after 18 months of hearings in which First Nations environmentalists and BC municipalities expressed mounting concerns about the project. Ben West is a tar sands campaign director with Forest Ethics Advocacy, one of the leading organizations in the campaign to stop the pipeline.
The National Energy Board in its history has never actually rejected a pipeline before. That being said, this seems like if they ever were going to reject a pipeline, this would be the one to reject. There was a record-breaking number of people who participated, close to 10,000 written submissions. The vast overwhelming majority were opposed. Even the government of British Columbia ultimately called for the pipeline not to be approved. And so did many of the expert witnesses, and all but two of the over 1,000 people who spoke during the oral submission. So we were hoping that the National Energy Board would come to a conclusion that this was not in the best interest of the people of BC or Canada, but unfortunately they did not do that.
The Dew Drop Inn, located in downtown Port Arthur in Thunder Bay, has served over 1 million meals since it opened in 1981. CILU's Earl Snow spoke with the president of the board of directors about who is currently accessing the soup kitchen.
I personally find it very distressing, the number of old people who are forced to rely on a soup kitchen, a feeding service, in order to meet some of their nutritional needs. If you're, and it's particularly elderly women, you know, single women, widows, if the only source of income is the basic government assistance, with the kind of prices that you have to pay in this city for the most basic accommodation, there ain't a heck of a lot left, you know, to feed yourself and look after your other needs, you know, water, electricity, and that kind of thing.
Last month, Canada Post announced plans to phase out urban door-to-door postal service over the next 5 years and eliminate 6,000 to 8,000 jobs. CKUT Radio in Montreal spoke with David Bleakney, the National Union Representative for Education with the Canadian Union of Postal Workers. Here he responds to the cuts.
Well, I mean, it's bizarre. I guess it's not completely unpredictable with a right-wing government and a desire to perhaps create a crisis at Canada Post and an over-embellished crisis. So my initial reaction wasn't all that much of shock.
Canada Post CEO Deepak Chopra, appointed by Harper, claims profitable business is hurting at Canada Post, so the Crown Corporation needs to be the first postal service in the industrialized world to eliminate door-to-door delivery. Bleakney raises issue with Chopra because Canada Post continues to turn a profit and pay executive bonuses, including Chopra's 33% performance bonus.
You're hearing numbers like billion-dollar losses. What are they talking about? When has there been a billion-dollar loss at the post office? We've had one loss in 17 years. So people are getting a pretty good service, and there's a whole number of new services that could be provided, postal banking, and so on. So the people who use the post office are the people that always have used the post office. There are some changes, of course, with the email and so on, and people not doing letter writing so much. But the internet, you know, has generated other things, you know, magazine subscriptions, books, people buying all kinds of products online. So to say that the post office doesn't provide a service anymore or some sort of relic of the past is problematic and just untrue. The post office, in fact, is doing quite well. They're having a record season. Who knows, they may make another profit this year.
In the face of these cuts announced at Canada Post, Bleakney is hopeful for an effective community-based campaign.
I also see it, frankly, as an opportunity to galvanize communities and to galvanize postal workers to actually respond to this in a really meaningful way and maybe do something to cease the decline of labor and the retreat of labor in this country to launch a battle that's actually worth fighting and worth winning.
To read a commentary published by David Bleakney titled, "This Post Office Belongs to Everyone," check out the latest edition of Briar Patch Magazine. To get involved in the campaign to stop the cuts at Canada Post, visit savecanadapost.ca. Again, that's savecanadapost.ca. This headline was filed for Groundwire by CKUT Radio in Montreal. That's it for the headlines. LU Radio in Thunder Bay is putting together a local music compilation due to be released in late 2014. It will feature many local Thunder Bay artists, including Ocean City Defender. Here's one of his new tracks from the album Star Tropics, released in Japan. You just heard Check the Tapes by Ocean City Defender. And now it's time for our feature stories. Kim Hornack from CFMH in St. John, New Brunswick brings us our first feature, reflecting on the mainstream media coverage of the North American Free Trade Agreement after 20 years.
The North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, was implemented 20 years ago. Many news outlets have been investigating the impact NAFTA has had on Canada, the United States, and Mexico. I spoke with Stuart True of the Council of Canadians about the recent coverage NAFTA has had in the mainstream media. With NAFTA's 20th anniversary, there's been a lot of mainstream media press celebrating the agreement. What do you see being the biggest lie or perhaps just perversion of facts that the press is presenting to the public?
Well, I think it's, for me, the biggest perversion perhaps of the facts is this idea that because trade increased under NAFTA, then naturally the agreement was good for everyone. I think if you look seriously at what has happened over the past 20 years in any of the three countries, I don't think we can make a very strong argument that people, workers, the general public, are all that much better off today than they were 20 years ago. I mean, if you go down to Mexico, I think it's most pronounced. We have 50% poverty rate. We have wages that are being depressed even lower than they are in China in order to attract manufacturing back to North America. In the United States, we have extremely high unemployment still since the Great Recession. Obviously, we can't say this is all the fault of NAFTA, but I think what you can point to NAFTA and previous free trade agreement with the United States in the case of Canada is it simply allowed corporations freedom to move wherever they wanted to, freedom to find the lowest wages possible, and that's had an obvious impact on wages, job security, and the types of employment in all three countries. I mean, we are much workers today in all three countries are in much more precarious position. Wages have stagnated for most workers in all three countries, and that's low income to middle income. We've seen the rich get richer across North America, which is obviously a global trend as well. And so, when you look at all that as a package, we've seen enormous amounts of environmental degradation across the North American region, environmental rules not being enforced in Mexico. These go against promises that were made when NAFTA was signed that, environment would become cleaner and environmental laws would become stricter. It just seems like the past 20 years we've seen a list of false promises or broken promises from NAFTA. And so I think we can't just say, it's been great, let's move on, let's sign more trade agreements, which is what the government is trying to do and what a lot of the pro-NAFTA voices are doing, but I think in a very dishonest way.
Thanks to Stuart True of the Council of Canadians for taking the time to speak with me for Groundwire. If you would like to learn more about what Stuart True or the Council of Canadians has to say about NAFTA, you can visit canadians.org.
In the aftermath of the cutting of federal funding to the Sisters in Spirit database in 2010, Indigenous women and allies are coming together to create a new community-based database project to document the tragic extent to which Indigenous women have gone missing and been murdered in Canada, and to contribute to building a larger movement. Scott Nye of Talking Radical Radio reports from Sudbury, Ontario.
Violence against Indigenous women has been a central aspect of the colonization of North America from its very beginning. Though resistance by Indigenous women over the centuries has been consistent and inspiring, and despite the important work done on the issue in the last decade by her organization and others, Audrey Huntley of the No More Silence Network says that little has improved in recent years.
We see new forms of resistance, new expressions of support, and it really does seem like so much more awareness. And yet three women died very violent deaths here in Toronto in less than a year. So there doesn't seem to be any abatement of the amount of violence. I actually feel like it's increasing, and it makes sense because we have a government that is pushing resource extraction, and so the violence on the land is increasing. It makes sense that violence against women would go hand in hand with that.
Huntley and Krista Williams of the Native Youth Sexual Health Network spoke of the collaboration between their organizations and other partners to build a community-based database of missing and murdered Indigenous women as a basis for taking action to end the violence. This is not the first attempt to build a database. a federally funded project run by the Native Women's Association of Canada, called Sisters in Spirit, had its funding cut in 2010 when the government shifted the responsibility and the information over to the RCMP. Huntley and Williams say that their networks have a different approach in mind.
One of the things that was really important to No More Silence when we got started was drawing the conclusion that a law and order approach can't be the answer for us. Smart women like Andrea Smith, you know, Angela Davis, they've critiqued how the women's movement fell into that trap of looking to state initiatives as the answer, and it hasn't worked. It's actually co-opted the strength of those movements. And I think people are becoming more aware of the need to build our own structures and not rely on government or institutional funding, but to create ways that are independent.
And part of that work is this partnership with the Native Youth Sexual Health Network and No More Silence around putting together community forums to get groups as well as academics and researchers who have been doing this work as well and get us all in the same room to talk about what we're doing. And then out of that came the need for a community-run database.
With that principle of being outside of the institutions. It is the only process that's going to be sustainable. And the database, you know, the Sisters in Spirit one that has been taken over by the RCMP is such a good example of that. There was a lot of hope when that funding was granted, and they did some research. They had 580 names, but no one ever had access to that database. The families would get together once a year and receive some support, and that was it. And now it's gone. So I think what we're doing now is going to take a long time, but we know that doing it this way will be more meaningful because it's actually there for the community to access.
According to Huntley and Williams, because their vision for the work sees it as part of larger struggles against colonization, it is important that they work with other Indigenous organizations, with Indigenous scholars, and with allies to figure out how to do the work in ways that ensure that it is part of building towards that decolonized future.
It is never just about the actual violent loss. It's always about the whole lifetime. And it really takes you down that path of intergenerational trauma, the loss of land, loss of family, family breakdown.
Our role in terms of the Native Youth Sexual Health Network in supporting this community-run database is really to reclaim control of how those numbers get recorded. So what does Indigenous data recording that is owned and controlled by Indigenous community look like, and what does that mean? Normally this has been done by the police or it's done by outside academic researchers. So we thought, wouldn't it be amazing for the families, you know, whose information, whose loved ones are going into this, to be at the center of deciding what that process is and how it can be respectful and not re-traumatizing. And also so that we get to decide, you know, what do those categories even mean? And so changing how we report on that violence, which also means that's going to have an impact on how we take action on violence.
Huntley said that there are big plans for the work in the coming year and beyond.
In the short term, we hope to be able to have an information drive, specifically reaching out to family members. We hope to have community partners by them who can help with that work. Currently, we have some PhD students who are helping us develop research guidelines, and we hope by the spring, when we're going to have another national meeting, to have completed a pilot model for Ontario that then can be replicated in other regions. Longer term, we want to get the database up to the existing numbers that we know about. That's going to be a lot of work because we don't just want to enter these names. We actually want to verify and investigate these circumstances. In the process of doing that, you see us continuing to build these relationships and capacity around just more structures that are outside of colonial dependency and that are focused on asserting sovereignty. In the long run, we do need to affect the actual violence. We don't just want to be documenting and investigating it. We actually want to be getting to a point where we're impacting and where perpetrators no longer feel so comfortable. We're still in a place where most Canadians tolerate that this is going on, and we need to get to a place where it's completely unacceptable.
For Groundwire, this is Scott Nye reporting for Talking Radical Radio in Sudbury, Ontario.
Outside. the time. Let's burn this whole city down. Let's burn this whole city down so we can see some light. It's cold all of the time. Stay home. All star running. Stay home. All star running. Place to live. Find me with ghosts breathing down my neck. Breathing down my neck. Cause I'm here for just a while more. And I can keep this under control. You keep telling me to go. You keep telling me to go. From this town. From this town.
You just heard Winter Dark by Nick Sherman.
You are listening to Groundwire, the fortnightly national news program by and for campus and community radio stations across Canada. It's a project of the NCRA, the National Campus and Community Radio Association. Next up is our Community Radio Report, a feature in every edition that highlights the activities of our radio sector. This week, a special treat. An interview with Carly Forbes, longtime national coordinator of Groundwire.
So I've been involved with Groundwire for about the last 2.5 years in the role of the national coordinator. Groundwire is totally volunteer-run. We have all volunteer contributors to the project. And my role is primarily coordinating who's going to be producing Groundwire. So Groundwire gets produced at a different radio station every 2 weeks. And so I coordinate who's producing it, and then making sure that the producer has everything they need to put the episode together. I think it's really important to get a great variety of perspectives in the program, and we really want to hear from local journalists in community radio from coast to coast, so getting those stories can offer some perspective of how folks are struggling in other places. And then it's also just a great way for, you know, someone's work to go a lot further. So you've put a lot of time into this interview and it plays on your local station and that's really great. But Groundwire allows it to go a little bit further. It gets out on the blog and it airs on over 20 community radio stations from coast to coast.
What kinds of topics is Groundwire looking for from producers?
We want self-representation from communities whose voices and narratives aren't being heard in the mainstream media. And so some of the priority bureaus that we have for the program include women's issues, issues around LGBTQ communities, self-representation from Indigenous issues. We also cover issues around environmental justice and grassroots organizing and migrant justice.
If people are interested in contributing pieces to Groundwire, how would they get in touch?
The easiest way to get in touch with us is by email. So we have a email account. It's groundwireprod, so groundwire, GROUNDWIRE, and then prod, PROD, at gmail.com.
Add Groundwire Radio News on Facebook.
And that's probably the fastest and easiest way to get in touch with us. Usually we like to know, you know, a bit of a summary of what the issue is that you're covering, who's going to be speaking, and then you can send us a clip or something from the archive to give us an idea of what it's going to sound like, and then we'll provide you with information. Usually for a headline, we're looking for 1 to 2 minutes, and for a feature, between 3 and 5. Generally for a feature, we'd ideally like to have 2 perspectives in the story.
So what's involved in actually putting the program together? You said that it's being produced at different radio stations. What do the radio stations have to do?
There's definitely always support available from the national coordination team, but generally the radio station puts out a call for contributions and contacts community radio producers in their network and at their own station to get involved. Then they receive submissions both from the national coordination team and from other community radio producers, so some features and headlines that come in. Then usually the producing station also puts together the community radio report. Then they do the work of putting all those pieces together into the format of the fully produced episode. And along with that comes writing a script. From there, the coordination team will distribute the episode over the internet to the other member stations that broadcast it.
Thanks to Carly Forbes for that interview. If you'd like to be a national news producer and perhaps even a national coordinator of the Groundwire Project, you can attend workshops at the upcoming Campus Community Radio Conference in June in Victoria, B.C. Or just start right in and try your hand at producing something now. The email contact again is groundwireprod@gmail.com. For Groundwire, I'm Frieda Worden.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced on Fort William First Nations territory at CILU in Thunder Bay, Ontario, by Groundwire coordinator Carly Forbes. Music this week was by Nick Sherman and Ocean City Defender. Headlines this week were written by Aaron Lakoff and Gretchen King. We also thank Scott Nye, Kim Hornack, Earl Snow, Josh Brandon, Jason Wellwood, and Krista Harper. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station, or download the latest episode at groundwire.ncra.ca. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.